Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. I'm Leslie Brokaw, sitting in for the vacationing Alan Chartock. This week, details on the status of prison legislation and the recently passed new milk laws. We'll hear about the Court of Appeals' narrower interpretation of the state's shield law for reporters and about why the state's chief administrative judge thinks that courts need guidelines on how to deal with defendants who have AIDS. All this, plus more, is ahead on this week's Legislative Gazette. Jonathan Salant of the Syracuse Herald Journal. You're down there at the New York State Capitol in the press room. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And let's talk about prisons. There's been a major package as part of the legislative session, which involved a whole variety of things, including the building of new cells, the taking of a barge that belongs to Britain, which would be converted into a floating cell, early release program, which would put more prisoners out a little bit earlier than they might have been otherwise. Also, shock incarceration for juveniles. Let's talk about the whole thing overall. You say that it was approved Wednesday night, correct?
Yeah, the state Senate, they were supposed to approve it Tuesday night. And there was a big disagreement in the Republican conference, and the majorities, the Senate majority, and they had to postpone consideration for a day, and they finally passed it last night, Wednesday night.
What kind of disagreement was it?
Well, the chairman of the Corrections Committee, Christopher Mager, from Brooklyn Republican, didn't like the idea of early release and letting people out of prisons. In part, I think the reason they want this early release is because the prisons are so overcrowded. Mager fought against it, and he was strong enough that enough other Republicans were also unwilling to support the proposal, which had been negotiated between Senate Majority Leader Anderson and Mel Miller, the Speaker of the Assembly, and the Governor.
And so what happened? The Senate Republicans eventually came around to back Warren Anderson's plan?
When your leader makes a deal, you really have to support him. Otherwise, he can't lead, and you don't get the benefits of being in the majority. I think they did some clarification. They did pass another bill that would clarify some of their positions. And for the most part, just a lot of, argument and negotiation, and Anderson saying, behind the closed doors, look, when we make a deal, this is the way it's supposed to be. And this is going to be the Republican position, and you guys are on the team, you play with it.
What do you think this bodes for Chris Mager?
Well, Mager is in a district that has been gone Democratic or Republican. It's seesawed. Four years ago, it was a Democratic district. And, Warren Anderson decides who's going to get the support and the money from the Republican campaign committee. And it's an interesting question to see whether what he does for Mager in 88 when Mager comes up for re-election.
Just to clarify the contents of what it was that they were debating, the earned eligibility proposal is going to allow some inmates to qualify for early parole if they do well getting an education or learning a trade while they're in prison, that's correct?
And for completing a completing a drug treatment program. It could be grant parole for inmates 2 months before their minimum sentence. And they estimate that'll free 1,500 beds a year, which you can then put in hardened criminals and, new people who've been sentenced to jail.
As part of this prison proposal as well, they've got some new prison spaces which are going to be created. That has to do partly with that barge and partly with some other stuff. What else do you know about that?
Well, they're supposed to set up two new 250-bed prisons, one in Essex County and one in Walcott in Wayne County. So, the legislators from that area were very happy to have it all. Have those type of things, and they're going to also have that barge, which will hold up 700 prisoners. So you're talking about, I think they're also talking about three new medium security prisons in Moravia, Marcy, and Malone. So you're talking about 4,800 new prison cells going to be built or added under this program.
John, I want to change the subject. The New York Court of Appeals ruled this week, New York State's highest court, that the information which is gathered by reporters, which is protected by a shield law, is actually much narrower. The shield law is much narrower, that it actually only protects that information which was gathered confidentially, where the person had told their source that the material that they were turning over is confidential material. What do you think about that? What's been the reaction down at the legislature this week on after that decision?
Well, the real danger of it is by not protecting things like the TV case where the television station refused to turn over outtakes, which are the film that did not appear on the air. It's like going through my notebooks. And the danger in this is then you're putting the judge into the position of being an editor who can go through your notebooks and say, why didn't you use this quote instead of that quote? Or why did you write this word on this part instead of using that? And, you know, when you're reporting, you're trying to get put together the facts. You're writing a story. You're on deadline. You're putting together a television show. You've got a certain time constraint. And you try to do a balanced, fair piece at the end. And it'll hinder reporting if every time you start writing something, you say, uh-oh, if I don't put this quote in, a judge might ask me why I didn't. And maybe I should use this quote over this quote. In fact, better still, I won't even do the story, and then nobody will ask me any questions. And that's the real fear about it.
Let me ask you, John, do you keep all of your notes?
No. Ever since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that police could search newsrooms, I throw out all my notes after a story appears in the newspaper. I've done it for years because I don't want anybody to go through my notes for that reason alone, because they don't know how I've written. I use codes. Half my stuff is scribble, and it's illegible to anybody but me. I might put observations down, and those are what I use in writing, but I don't think that those should be, I should be cross-examined in a court of law on that.
John, we're talking on Thursday afternoon, and it's likely the session may wrap up in the next day or two. There was one particular bill that you followed from beginning to it appears end, and that's the Apple Muffin Bill.
Well, it still has to be signed by the governor, and the question is whether the governor will go ahead with it. But a group of North Syracuse fourth graders were doing a story, doing a unit on state government, and they came up with the idea to try to get a bill become a law. And their designation was to make the apple muffin the official state muffin, apples being the number one agricultural crop in New York State. And they came down to Albany, baked hundreds of muffins, and handed them out to legislators and staff members and members of the press, and got a lot of attention for this.
And what has the governor said lately about whether he's going to approve this or not?
He hasn't said anything. There's a concern of something that was brought up in the New York City papers primarily, that this is very frivolous, the legislature wasting its time, though I can't see why a half hour out of a six-month session is considered a waste of time. I think all those one-house bills is a much worse waste of time that nobody says anything about. But the question is, well, do you encourage this stuff? If you sign the bill, maybe there'll be 1,000 fourth-grade classes coming down next year. I don't see the merit to it, but enough people are saying that there's a question, that it's not a sure thing. I hope the governor signs the bill. If he asks me, I would tell him to sign it, but there's still that possibility that's going on.
And of course we know that he's not going to ask you, John.
No, but if he would, that would be the advice I give him.
Okay, Jonathan Salant, thanks for talking to us from the Syracuse Herald Journal. Back in May, the Legislative Gazette spoke with New York Senator Tarki Lombardi, chairman of the Senate Health Committee, about the degree requirements for nurses. Currently, New York State nurses are not required to have a college degree before entering a nursing program. Senator Lombardi said that he supported maintaining the minimum requirements for nurses because of the shortage of men and women enrolling in nursing schools, and because nurses with advanced degrees often leave their nursing responsibilities for the administrative positions where the money is better. In response to that interview, Ellen Burns and Martha Orr, the president and executive director of the New York State Nurses Association, spoke with Alan Shartok explaining why they support more stringent education requirements for nurses.
I think the highest priority is passage of what has come to be known as the Entry into Practice Bill. That is the bill which will require a minimum of baccalaureate preparation for professional nursing and a minimum of an associate degree for associate nursing.
Ellen Burns, that's fine, say all the people that I talk to in hospitals and around, and people like Senator Tarki Lombardi and others, but who's going to carry the bedpans? I mean, if everybody has to have a college degree, who's going to do the scut work in the hospitals?
Well, I hate to hear you equate bedpans with scut work, because carrying bedpans is a very important part of nursing care. And when you talk about carrying bedpans as if it were a simple task, if you actually look at the patients today who require that kind of service, they either have such profound self-care deficits or their medical condition is so unstable that they require the care of a professional nurse, not the care of somebody who is inadequately trained on the job.
But we can't even find enough nurses right now, and you're already saying that you're going to do something that's going to make it even more difficult to find nurses.
One of the reasons you cannot find nurses is because admissions to and graduations from schools of nursing have dropped precipitously in the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And the major reason for that is that the confusion of the educational picture in nursing has discouraged people from becoming nurses. For a short period of time, when it looked as if we were going to straighten out our educational mess, enrollments in schools of nursing were up. They are very, very seriously down now. Unless you make nursing an attractive career for bright people, the shortage of nurses is going to get worse.
Yes, but is a baccalaureate the answer, or is just paying them more money the answer?
There's no evidence that the major problem that nurses have in practice today is money. Money is a factor, to be sure. But there are more important factors that are related to control of practice, to the kind of decision-making, to things that have to do with job satisfaction. Mm-hmm. The ability to give care. That's what nurses are asking for.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Martha Orr is the executive director of the association. You get around. Do you hear from the LPNs at all, or do you only hear from those people who have baccalaureates?
Well, you're talking about a whole variety of nurses. Certainly we hear from the LPNs. There's no question.
Do they
about
like this
that.
Entry-level idea that only people with college degrees?
Interestingly enough, many LPNs do see it as their future,
mm-hmm.
because they see themselves being put out of business in very short order unless they, too, improve their educational requirements for practice. To add to what Ellen said, I think that what has to be understood is this is a means of elevating the entire educational credentials of all those who would practice nursing, all of those who would provide service to the public that is commonly called nursing.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that our educational system has not changed in 100 years, and certainly I'm sure that you and your listeners appreciate the fact that the care required by people has changed drastically in 100 years, should be statement enough that it is high time we enter the world of all other professions and achieve that educational credential.
Well, now, in fact, the few times I've been in the hospital, I always had the idea that nurses were running the show, doing all of the major work. And is what you're saying is because they're doing that work, they have, and because doctors just drop around every so often, that the nurses really do have to have a better educational background?
Absolutely. There is no question about the technological aspects of care, the psychological aspects of care. The entire range of service that is provided has become much more complex. Nurses need that education in order to do what the public needs.
Mm-hmm. Ellen Burns, as the president of the association, is it your sense that there is a war between doctors and nurses, that the doctors are feeling that nurses are somehow moving in on their areas, first of all, as nurse practitioners and in other ways?
I don't know that I would describe it as a war. I think one of the things which is difficult for some doctors is to recognize that nursing has a professional practice of its own, which is independent and not under the domination of medicine. Many of them become very nervous when they think about nurses in more independent positions. I think the physicians who actually work where nurses are responsible for very important decisions appreciate the fact that nurses need more education.
Ellen Burns and Martha Orr are president and executive director of the New York State Nurses Association. You're listening to the Legislative Gazette. There are no uniform guidelines for how courts should handle defendants or other court participants who have the disease AIDS. Some might argue that no guidelines are needed because the disease is not transmittable through the casual contact of a courtroom. However, prison guards, traffic people, court attendants, clerks, judges, juries, and lawyers have all begun expressing concerns and apprehensions about potential problems. That's according to New York's Chief Administrative Judge Albert Rosenblatt, who announced this week that he'll be holding hearings next month in New York City, Albany, and Buffalo to explore handling procedures. He says already there have been some unusual incidents arising from defendants with the syndrome, including one where the hearing was held outdoors. He says the problem there arose when a judge had difficulty arranging transportation for a defendant, and the available location did not have large enough indoor facilities.
Recently, a case arose in which someone who was believed to be afflicted with AIDS had his case conducted out in open air. And this was done with the consent and indeed the encouragement of everyone involved. And I guess that was okay at the time, but people were kind of left with a feeling that they were at sea as to how to proceed. So they did it by an ad hoc determination. They did what they thought was best. It turned out that everyone agreed that they go outdoors. But surely they weren't acting out of a statewide policy that all AIDS cases be handled in the parking lot. And yet under the circumstances, if everyone wanted to do that, and if everyone, including the person who was afflicted with AIDS, said, yes, thank you very much, I would prefer to be out in the parking lot, which is what I understand what his reaction was, then, you know, so far so good on that case. But I don't know that that should be a model.
Let me ask you about specifically what kind of concerns you're thinking of. My initial reaction is thinking, oh no, people are starting to go hysterical. The idea that if they sit in a courtroom with somebody that has the disease, they're going to contract it, which is completely antithetical to what we've heard from health department officials right over the last couple of years. Are there specific instances of, say, people who are defendants potentially biting the people that are bringing them into court? Or we've heard about people in prisons who have thrown urine at prison guards. Are those the specific things that you're worried about?
Yes, those are. And they come from a segment of the criminal justice system that is in closest contact with prisoners, possibly, and with those that are in the high-risk groups. So we have an understandable concern on the part of court attendants, guards, people who speak through their unions, saying that they're exposed to this kind of peril. That's all understandable, and we recognize it, and we're sensitive to that, and we don't want to be inconsiderate of that. On the other hand, we have to make sure that those anxieties do not interfere with the fairness of a trial itself, and that the essential fairness of the court is not in any way compromised by what may strike some as excessive levels of apprehension. I have to myself gauge what is an accurate basis for concern, and see whether fashioning a rule might alleviate some of those concerns. But surely we wouldn't want to have those anxieties reach the level where they come into the courtroom and insinuate themselves in the trial itself.
Do you have any preliminary thoughts on what the state should be doing?
I think it would be premature, and I want to go into this, Leslie, with an open mind, and we have really no guidance from any other initiatives in other states or other state judicial systems. So we're going to be learning as we go along, as I think it should be. We're going to be listening to public health experts. We're going to be drawing on all manner of available resources, the best that we can acquire, maybe people from the CDC in Georgia, New York State health experts, and then after hearing all those who can speak authoritatively on the subject, we can say, well, based on present information, such and such is the case. Based on present information and on the best information possible, we think that the trial can be managed compatibly with safeguarding everyone's rights by doing ABC. We feel that it is unnecessary to do XYZ. We feel that 1, 2, 3 are appropriate safeguards, and go from there.
Is this growing out of anxiety primarily by the people that handle defendants? In other words, is it the unions that are coming to you and saying we have to formulate guidelines on this?
No, they haven't. I don't want it to reach the point of hysteria. We don't want it to reach the point of uncontrollable levels of anxiety. We're trying to do it anticipatorily so that we don't have a crisis confrontation on our hands. We're trying to do it in a deliberate, circumspective way, with input from all interested sources, and what we hope to come out of it would be an intelligible, coherent body of knowledge that could direct us toward a sensible rule. And you make a very good point in asking whether we've been assaulted by expressions from guards or union people. We haven't. They've been very good. They have made known their fears, but there's been no confrontation or anything like that. We want to make sure that they feel protected and that the court system is not endangered by any kind of inordinate spectacle that might result.
Final question. Would these be rules that would be applicable only when the defendant has AIDS or when, say, any witness in any kind of case coming to the stand has AIDS? And this would it be just for people that had visual symptoms of AIDS?
Yeah. Well, I don't know why it should be limited. I think the same, if there's any danger that's demonstrable, it would be so regardless of the person's status as a defendant or as a witness or anything else. The danger of the complicating the trial is somewhat greater in a criminal case, as you pointed out. Someone sitting there on trial, and if there are if there's a spectacle surrounding that person, it could prejudice that person's right to a fair trial. It might be a little different with a witness, but certainly they would, in both categories, we would be concerned. But we want to act on the most authoritative knowledge as to what is or is not communicable.
Albert Rosenblatt is Chief Administrative Judge for the State of New York. He says that after next month's hearings, it will take several months to formulate guidelines for dealing with AIDS-infected people in the courtrooms. Lawmakers this week approved a bill to change the way that New York regulates the sale of milk. The bill changes a system set up in the Depression years to protect dairy farmers from competition. We talked about the bill with Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen.
Prior to this, there had been a regulation on where milk could be marketed, and the regulation provided for county-by-county authorization to sell milk. Now we're going to have a statewide licensing territory, eliminate the county by county licensing setup. This will go into effect in April 1988, and most milk dealers, if they can show that they have financial soundness and wouldn't default to the producer, well qualify for a license to be a dealer in New York State.
Now, the three different groups affected New York consumers of milk and New York farmers and milk dealers that operate in New York. How are they all going to be affected by the laws?
We think that consumers will be benefited from the greater amount of competition. We do not think there will be any adverse effect on New York's dairy farmers. In fact, the other provision of the bill that enhances the Milk Producers Security Fund will make it more sure that they get paid for their milk and that there isn't a default to producers. The effect upon the dairies who actually deliver the milk is difficult to estimate. I think some dealers may profit to a greater extent because they are more competitive. Certainly some of them could be hurt.
This was a fairly contentious bill for much of the session. What were the final pieces that had to fall in place where the negotiations were the most delicate towards the end?
Well, I think that everybody all along felt that it was necessary to pass a law this year. As you know, Governor Cuomo has been urging this kind of a law for several legislative sessions, but the intervention of the federal court into the New York system made it absolutely necessary that this year the legislature took action. There were differences between the Senate and Assembly approaches at first and some difference with the administration, but those differences were really minor, and the resolution on the Milk Producers Security Fund and the other payment dates and that kind of thing, I never felt were an enormous challenge, and we felt confident all along that this was one of the major pieces of legislation that would in fact be adopted, and it has.
Now, this bill affects not just interstate milk sales. In other words, an upstate person will now be able to sell with more ease downstate, but people from outside of New York State will be able to come into the state more easily?
That's right.
Is there any guarantee for New York farmers that eventually they, too, will have the ability to sell outside of the state the way that people, say, from Massachusetts or Jersey can come in-state at this point?
There is a provision in this bill that requires the Attorney General to take action to open up neighboring states' markets to New York milk. Right now, that isn't a critical issue for most producers because we really are short in our supply of milk here in New York while there's a national surplus, and that should give us time to take action. Currently, I understand the Connecticut and Massachusetts markets are very close to New York milk. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, is quite open, so the producers in the southern tier, where I come from, don't have too much of a problem penetrating the Pennsylvania market. So we'll have to take selected action under this measure, and the bill does provide for authority for the Attorney General to take that action, and hopefully there'll be full and fair competition throughout the Northeast milk market area.
New York Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. And that's it for the Legislative Gazette this week. Our show is edited and produced in the studios of WAMC Albany, and help this week came from Brenda McMahon, Dan Brody, and of course Alan Shartok. I'll be back again next week for more news about the New York State government. For now, I'm Leslie Brokaw.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.